Hello and welcome to South Asia Chart, a podcast series brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm your host, Dr. Yogesh Joshi, and today we are going to discuss the pleasantly surprising twist in India-Pakistan relations with the recent ceasefire agreement on the line of control. Our guest today needs no introduction. Professor C. Rajamohan is one of the foremost minds on India's foreign and security policy and has personally witnessed many twists and turns in Indo-Pak relations over the last four decades. Professor C. Rajamohan is Director, Institute of South Asian Studies. Earlier, Professor Mohan was Professor of South Asian Studies at Jawaharlal Nehru University, New Delhi, and at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies, Nanyang Technological University, Singapore. Professor Mohan is one of India's leading commentators on India's foreign policy, and he has been associated with several think tanks in New Delhi, including the Institute of Defense Studies and Analysis, the Center for Policy Research, and the Observer Research Foundation. He was also the founding director of Carnegie India, New Delhi, the sixth international center of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. Professor Mohan, welcome to South Asia Chart.
Thank you, Yogesh. Thank you for inviting me.
To begin with, India and Pakistan have agreed to observe ceasefire agreements on the line of control. More interestingly, this declaration coincided with the second anniversary of the Pulwama terrorist attacks and India's anti-terrorist airstrikes in Balakot. What are the reasons behind this new thaw in the bilateral relationship?
One of the interesting things about India-Pak relations is when you think nothing is happening, when you think things couldn't get worse, and suddenly you'll see a moment when they're beginning to talk again. Sometimes when you think everything is going swimmingly well, and suddenly you see something happens and the whole process breaks down. So it's been a kind of on again, off again peace process. So I don't think it has anything to do with the anniversary of the Pulwama and the Balakot incidents. Quite clearly, the reporting on the latest development suggests the back channel, that is the contact between the two sides, has been in play for some time. And there is no special date needed to announce an agreement that appears to have been reached. Whatever the reason is, I think it's an interesting moment between the two countries. And there is, for some reason, I think at least some people see the prospect for a reasonable length of time when things could be relatively calm, especially on the line of control, which has seen intense amounts of violence in recent years.
Surely. The Modi government, it seems, has mastered the art of keeping both domestic and international observers on tenterhooks vis-a-vis its foreign policy. What can the ceasefire agreement tell us about Modi's foreign policy strategy, but also how it impacts his domestic political agenda?
No, I think Modi has seen, we've seen him, being a strong leader with strong popular support in India. He's in a position where he can change the narrative on Pakistan. He could produce surprises because, unlike his predecessor, Manmohan Singh, he's not constantly looking over his shoulder to see whether he has the support, whether this will play badly. So I think he has the initiative. And now, over the last 6 years, he also has the experience that he's handled many international leaders. So I think sort of the level of confidence that even the most controversial issue, that he can make the case for it without losing either face or support domestically in this case. We've seen that he can actually make bold moves vis-a-vis Pakistan. If you go back to 6 years ago when he was first sworn in as India's Prime Minister, he surprised everyone by inviting Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif for his inauguration in Delhi. That was in 2014 May. In 2015, he kind of on a 1 hour, 2 hour notice, he flew from Kabul to Lahore to visit Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif at his residence because there was the wedding and it was also Nawaz Sharif's birthday. That you have a leader, that too between India and Pakistan, can fly in on a short notice and to go without too much security, where Indian security detail was in a tizzy about what will happen to the Indian PM. So I think he has that gumption to do things the ability to be able to face the consequences of a potentially difficult decision. For example, if you recall, Manmohan Singh, he wanted very eager to go to Pakistan, but in the 10 years of his prime ministership, he never could make it because there was so much of hand-wringing in the Congress party. There was so much of hesitation of doing something different with Pakistan. But I think that is the advantage Modi has, and I think he knows how to play that quite well, both to domestic and international audiences.
Right. No, that's very interesting. Many analysts claim, though, that Modi government's embrace of the ceasefire agreement is forced by the threat of a two-front war situation in the subcontinent. The fact that the declaration on ceasefire came along with the, at the time when India and China are disengaging from the Himalayan frontier after almost a year of crisis. Do you think the Modi government has undertaken these measures to relieve the military pressure on the line of control and line of actual control? How far is this reasoning valid?
No, I think one of the problems I've seen in international affairs is that people tend to relate to contemporaneous events because they've happened simultaneously, you would think there is a relationship between them. While the Indian military leaders have always talked about a two-front problem, as your own work has shown, you have two frontiers. There was always going to be that possibility, but India has tended to handle both these frontiers as separate issues. That is, we've had frequent conflicts with Pakistan, we've had conflicts with China. This idea that these two are related in terms of the diplomatic activity, I think is far-fetched as far as I can see, because we didn't see through the crisis that Pakistan doing something extra to put pressure on India. Nor did India's conflict with Pakistan in Pulwama or other places, China mobilize major support. So I think because they happen together, I mean, it's easy to come to that conclusion. Because there is some reporting, whether we can choose to believe it or not, is that the initiative has actually come from Pakistan. I think that is far more interesting because after all, India is not the only country with two-front problem. Pakistan has two fronts where much is happening on its western frontier in Afghanistan, and China, which is also having to deal with a surprisingly challenging positions that Biden administration has taken, and the confrontation with the US and its allies in Asia. So I think everyone has a two-front problem. That doesn't mean they've all acted simultaneously to produce the move on the Indian side.
Surely, which gives us a nice segue to our next question, which is often that we often focus on India rather than Pakistan. We are too obsessed with the pulls and pressures on New Delhi, but not Pakistan. There must be some factors which have prodded Islamabad to accept the ceasefire agreement. Can you explain how we should read Pakistan's acceptance of the agreement, and what are the domestic, regional, and international pressures on Islamabad?
Because I would see, I mean, Pakistan, at least you can see five broad reasons. I mean, as we say again, analytically, we try to bring order to what happens in countries, and that's our job as analysts. But it does not necessarily mean that, look, the leaders are calculating everything in such rational, clear fashion. But the fact is, General Bajwa, General Qamar Javed Bajwa, the Chief of Army Staff of Pakistan, has been talking about peace on the frontiers for quite some time. It's not that he suddenly discovered the value of peace on the border. You recall in 2018, there was a similar initiative on ceasefire, but it did not work out. And we've seen, even after Pulwama and Balakot tensions, now there was the initiative on Kartarpur corridor to open up the Punjab border for the Sikh pilgrims. And if you go to the 2019 elections, I mean, you saw Prime Minister Imran Khan saying, Modi is the best bet for Pakistan. This is again after Pulwama and Balakot, saying Modi has the strength to do a deal while Congress is too afraid to do a deal. So for them, I think, the need to engage India has always been a major imperative for Pakistan. India could live without engaging Pakistan in a general sense, as a larger country, not under great pressure. Well, for Pakistan, India looms large. I mean, for all its strong relationship with the US and with China. India is the, shall we say, I mean, the principal problem that for Pakistan. So I think whether they've always fought on the terms of engagement, they're also very eager to have an engagement with India. But I would say the current situation is driven by at least four or five things. I mean, I think the first is the recognition that, look, the Pakistani effort at getting the world to condemn India for what it did in August 2019, when the Modi government changed the constitutional status of Jammu and Kashmir, abolished Article 370 and 35A, which had given a certain type of autonomy for the Kashmir state, and then broke up the state into two union territories, Jammu and Kashmir on one side and Ladakh on the other. I mean, certainly they were surprised. They were hoping that, look, they could go to the world and say, look, what India has done is completely unacceptable. And we saw how China took up that issue in the Security Council, but they could not mobilize enough support. I mean, I think the West, certainly France and US and later Britain, as well as Russia, backed India. So I think India fended off that maneuver that somehow the change in August 2019 would bring the world like a ton of bricks on India. The second, I think, is the costs of this strategy that Pakistan has adopted. That is, use asymmetric strategy, that is, use terrorism to put pressure on India, because India was much bigger, much larger economy, 10 times larger today. But it thought there was this possibility of using jihadi groups to put pressure on India. That strategy seemed a fairly, you know, low cost and high effect on India all these years. But now with the FATF, that is the Financial Action Task Force, that the world's tolerance for the kind of strategy that Pakistan has pursued, that has declined. So I think Pakistan has got trapped into this FATF constraint. The economy is doing badly because of the international pressure on the terror financing. So I think there is a fundamental case there. And related to this, of course, is the fact that Pakistan economy today is smaller than Bangladesh's. For a country that was seen as a progressive economy in the 1950s and the early 60s, as a country that had one of the best prospects in Asia, today finds itself in a terrible situation and in the economic sense. So therefore they need to, and in fact, there's been Bajwa's theme that, look, we need, Pakistan needs to change, reorient itself, et cetera. And then you have the diplomatic level. Pakistan has lost a lot of its traditional friends who have moved closer to India. The US, of course, is a classic example. You had Saudi Arabia, you had UAE, which have traditionally backed Pakistan. They're not even neutral between India and Pakistan. So in that sense, Pakistan had to recalibrate. There were enough reasons to recalibrate its position. So I think that's what probably compelled it to take this initiative. This does not mean Pakistan is ready to surrender to India. For them, at least, this is actually take a fresh look at the challenges they have and try and deal with the situation as they get, because leaving this in the same format would make it even harder as time passes by. And all trajectories indicate the gap between India and Pakistan is going to widen, just as the gap between China and India has widened in this case. So they needed to arrest this, find a way to claw back. So at least whether we can see this as tactical or strategic, but it makes sense, I think, for them to get a pause, even if it's a pause, not a breakthrough for peace, but at least a suspension of hostilities might give it a chance to deal with India and start and take a fresh look at what their prospects are.
There is another idea that there might be some quid pro quo, but on the ground, it doesn't seem to be the case. Modi government has continued to follow its agenda on Kashmir, and there appears to be no retraction from its position, Article 370. On the other hand, at the same time when these negotiations were going on, India actually stated its position on preemptive use of force in the UN Security Council. So is it a master stroke by Modi government that the dialogue is the only quid pro quo being offered to Pakistan?
No, I think India has offered a, you know, they call it quid pro quo or not, India has agreed to talk. Because until now, the Prime Minister was saying, look, I mean, till you stop terrorism, I'm not going to talk. Now, Prime Minister Modi, that is. Now, with Pakistan agreeing to suspend, at least, I mean, ceasing fire, and hopefully it involves a deal on ending terrorism, and for India agreeing to talk on Kashmir. So that's why the short cryptic statement by the two military commanders, the DGMOs, or the Director Generals of Military Operation, where they talk about the core concern, addressing the core concerns of each other. So that is the operational part. That's the ceasefire is the context in which both sides will address each other's core concerns. You know very well, Pakistan's core concern is Kashmir and India's core concern is terrorism, that is cross-border terrorism. So they've agreed to talk. Now, how they will proceed is what the story, I think, for the next few weeks and months will be. But India has agreed to talk. To negotiate, you would think it is about agreeing to talk on Kashmir. How those talks will go, that doesn't mean India has given up its position, nor Pakistan has given up its position. That Pakistan gets finally India talking on Kashmir again. If you recall, through 2015 and 16, there was an attempt to construct a dialogue. Modi and Nawaz Sharif had agreed on a UFA framework. Kashmir was one of the subjects. So India has had no problem talking about Kashmir. Whether its positions are good enough for Pakistan is a different story. But they've agreed to talk. And I think so you go back to a point where both sides begin to talk and address each other's concerns. So that gives Pakistan some face that, look, we're starting the dialogue again. But there are going to be issues, I think, as you're familiar with, the moment you start talking, the expectations on both sides and how they could be quickly crashed. For example, we're not sure whether the Pakistan army, for all its good intent, can it really control all violent groups on its territory? Now, if there is a big incident, would India say, look, this is deliberate and we're going to hit back again? And that's going to lead to, the breakdown of the peace process. Similarly, for Pakistan, what does it want to see as progress? Because India agrees to talk, but Pakistan needs to show some progress on Kashmir to its population to continue the dialogue. This has always been the problem of how do you manage this tension of preventing violence for a long time and to show progress on Kashmir. For a short period in 2004 to 2007 and 8, I think we had seen that period where there was a prolonged period of suspension of violence. India and Pakistan seemed to have negotiated a framework on Kashmir. They also agreed to do a lot of confidence building measures, step up people to people contact, trade, commerce in Punjab, in Kashmir. So we could imagine such a framework where the three legs of the process can begin to move. Talks, no violence, and confidence building measures. And then that leaves us a bigger question that, look, does Pakistan need immediate results on Kashmir? That is, some people expect India would reverse Article 370. It's unlikely to do that. But can India do things, for example, in Kashmir? For example, it promised already to restore the statehood. Then Pakistan has historically demanded internal changes in Kashmir, end repression, withdraw armed forces, improve the human rights. I mean, that's been some of the demands that they've made in the past. And India, in any case, has an interest of its own. If there is no violence, India does not need the level of troops it needs to keep. If you remember the agreement between Musharraf and Manmohan Singh, General Musharraf in 2005-07, demilitarization was one of the goals. Pakistan would reduce the violence, therefore India would agree to reduce the number of troops in Kashmir. So I think if there is no violence, there's no need for checking people, there is no need to kind of securitization, if you guys as political scientists would call it, that is a consequence of the conditions of violence that existed. So there is room to imagine that if you move one, the others can also move. But we couldn't fully try this out in that period. But can it be done this time? Is an open-ended thing. And then, if both sides agree to trade, for example, until now Pakistan, India-Pakistan came very close to normalizing the trade relations when Zardari became the president of Pakistan in 2012, 2013. Pakistan declare. I mean, it is not something secret. The cabinet said, look, we will go to MFN, that is Most Favored Nation Trading Relationship with India. There was a series of negotiations between the commerce secretaries. But in the last minute, it was stopped. At the time, the report was that Pakistan Army said, look, you can't do trade without progress on Kashmir. Now, the question is, can Pakistan ease up a bit on that and say, look, a practical cooperation as India keeps talking on Kashmir, can you do trade while India keeps seen as making some progress? So I think that's an interesting opening that exists. And there are a whole lot of, because the relationship is at such a low level, there are no ambassadors, there's no, all contact has been stopped. And then there is the pandemic. So there are, which both countries have a stake in doing things together. There is the Delhi and Lahore have the same weather, the same pollution. So you could do a lot of things without having to resolve Kashmir question or addressing the final solutions to it. So I think if there is seen as movement, then can you open up the template a little bit where things begin to move and then the conditions improve for both sides. A positive environment can be built up. But then you have to last sufficiently long for violence to, hold back. So it's a delicate dance. But I'm not pessimistic like most people are that India must give it a shot and see if it works. Because in the end, I mean, India has as much stake as Pakistan. Having a peaceful frontier would be in its own interest as well.
Surely. Thanks so much for uncovering those multi-layered complexities which bedevil this relationship. But I want to ask you the last question in a sense, which is about the larger implications of this deal and the role of US and China in the recent thaw between India and Pakistan.
Look, I think, in India, there's a long tradition of, believing that for anything that happens in the subcontinent, the Americans must be at it. Whether the CIA destabilizing or whether it is the American government is pushing things on India and Pakistan. Americans were actively involved in mediating. If you go back to the 50s and the 60s, and then in the 90s, where, because the frequent crisis, the fear of a nuclear escalation, you saw the Americans come in quite frequently. And that was always, because of the nuclear factor, the Americans and sometimes the British together used to come in very quickly. And there was a time when US and China talked about stabilizing the subcontinent. When Clinton visited, Beijing, I think it was probably, in the mid-90s, that idea that the international community must intervene to stabilize India-Pakistan has been there for a long time. And interestingly, if you see the last few crises, if you say Pulwama Balakot, the Americans did come in and their intervention actually helped India. In the past, Pakistan used to raise the nuclear alarm, demand Americans come, knock India's, some sense into India's head and compel it to talk Kashmir. Today, I think Indians, after the initial two crises, they figured out you can raise the threat of a nuclear escalation, as it did in the Balakot case, and tell the Americans, look, you tell him to stop violence. So I think it is, if you see in the last two instances, about certainly in the Balakot case, the American intervention, initial reaction was, look, India has the right to self-defense. National Security Advisor Bolton and later Pompeo said that very clearly. If a major terror attack, India has every right to hit back at Pakistan. And then when the skirmishes took place, both in the air forces, et cetera, there was speculation that the Americans put a lot of pressure on Pakistan to release the Wing Commander Abhinandan, who they had captured after he bailed out on Pakistani territory. So India is no longer afraid of American intervention, because today India is confident. The India-US relationship has moved forward. In the past many decades, Kashmir, Pakistan, India's stability was seen as a single package. But then now there is the China question. US sees India as an important partner in balancing Asia. India is now a member of the Quad. So it's no longer, India-US relationship is no longer tied to Pakistan. It's got a bigger agenda. Therefore, that that also compels, I think, persuades US to calm things down, but not against India. So that's a big change. So the other, I mean, I don't think Chinese had any role in this because Chinese have never had that kind of a position between India and they had big influence with Pakistan, but never the influence with India. But there is some speculation that probably the British had had some interest because historically the British and the Americans did it together. The speculation, of course, is that that the talks, the so-called secret talks, one round of it at least took place in London. So we don't know how much of a role because India does not much trust London when it came to Kashmir or India-Pak relations because of the historic positions of Britain. But it's entirely possible that in the context of improving India-British relationship, if the British had used their good offices to start this process in the beginning, it's possible, but there is no evidence at this point to any of that. But more importantly, I think India and Pakistan, know each other very well. I mean, that anytime they want to do things, they have always found a way to, connect with each other. The back channels have operated at many levels. Sometimes the heads of the intelligence agencies, sometimes, secret envoys. So it's not that it's difficult for Delhi and Rawalpindi, for that matter, to talk to each other. So I don't think they need someone to help. And I think if there's enough motivation, they could always do it on their own. And I would think 90% of the energy came from both of them directly. And if someone like London helped do some, initial assistance or good offices, and one shouldn't be surprised.
Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts on such an important issue. It is always a pleasure listening to you. I think our viewers share the same assessment. You were listening to South Asia Chat. For all those who have tuned in from across the world, thanks so much for your time. To learn more about our work, please visit us at ises.nus.edu.sg. Thank you.